Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Sam Fenwick. Coming up today, the boss of one of Germany's best-known companies says the next government must attract more foreign investment.
I think we need to rethink the economical policy, and I hope that whoever forms the new government really puts a lot of effort into it.
Hear from South Africa as the country tries to get back on its feet after years of power cuts and looks to address its unemployment issues.
I've been around to different places giving out my CVs and that, but there was no feedback on that. And then I just gave up like a month ago saying that I'm not going to go out because there's no income, but I'm spending on going out to places to give my CV in.
And Saudi Arabia has expanded its dominance in global sports with major investments in boxing, golf, motor racing and tennis. So could football be next? That's all to come here on World Business Report in the next 30 minutes. First today, the CEO of Europe's largest travel operator and one of Germany's biggest multinational companies, TUI, has told this programme that Germany needs to do more to attract investment. Sebastian Abel says the next government must reduce bureaucracy for the economy to grow. Elections are set to take place in Germany in February. Mr. Abel's comments come after TUI reported a 12% increase in revenue this year compared with 2023, but the company predicts that growth will slow to between 5 and 10% next year. He told me that 2024 has been the year of the package holiday, driven by pressures on family budgets leading to customers seeking more affordable holiday options.
I mean, we have seen a revival of the package holiday because people like the security, they like the service concept, they like the price stability. They don't have to think what do they combine with something else. So people are fine.
And we see that, don't we, in inflationary periods, that people do want to know what they're spending on and they're not going to be hit by any hidden extras.
Yes, people know what they pay. They know what kind of product they get, if it's all inclusive, if it's breakfast only or half board. They know about transport from the airport to the hotel. And they know if something goes wrong, that there's someone they can talk to.
Is there still then a lot of pent-up demand from the pandemic? We talked about that a lot last year, didn't we? But is things starting to normalize now?
Yeah, I think it has normalized. I mean, now it's more about the weather, about time, about flexibility. We're changing a lot in TUI to be more flexible towards the customers. And that should bring us customers for which TUI had not been the first choice in the beginning.
You're hailing it as a good year. But when you announced the results earlier today, the share price did fall. It's rebounded. Do you pay much attention to that share price?
Yes and no. I mean, I never thought that it's important what the share price is at a specific moment, because to manage the share price is something very short term. It's more important to manage the company so that the value of the company increases and therefore the share price goes up. On the other hand, like you say, why has it gone down? And after the release, it got up 20 cents, then it got down 70 cents. Now it's back again. So of course, we look into it. Is there something in communication? Is there a rumor which is not true? So we do it. But fundamentally, we look into the performance of the company to improve the performance and to let the market know what we plan to do.
What are your predictions then for 2025?
Hotel business, we see a steady growth with a lot of international customers. On cruise, it has been virtually sold out. Despite the incremental capacity, it will be sold out. So on the market and airline side, on the passenger side, there will be a growth within TUI. How big it will be, we have to see. It would not be good if I now would give you a number, because there might be very difficult to predict at the moment. I think the good message is it will be a significant growth.
You talk in the annual statement about sustainability. You aim to halve the carbon footprint of your hotels and resorts by 2030, reaching net zero in 10 years. Who's going to pay for things like putting solar panels on the top of buildings?
A lot has changed. I remember 5 years ago, people thought it's altruistic to do so. Today, for these things are good business cases. Therefore, I'm always in favor of open technology, not saying you have to do this or that. A lot of things we do now have a reasonable short return of the investment. So it's not anything to do that's altruistic. It supports the business. It supports what the customer wants. And it's not a burden to profitability.
So if I book a hotel in Greece for the summer, will it be the hotel that pays for those solar panels, or will it be TUI?
I mean, it's a great investment case. So at the end, it will pay off in a decent time period, 5 years, for example. And the investment is taken by us, it's taken by the hotelier. It depends on who owns the property.
Aviation fuel is one of the biggest carbon emitters if you're going to go on holiday. You're aiming to reduce emissions from your airlines by 24% by 2030. At the moment, sustainable aviation fuel makes up a tiny fraction, doesn't it, of the actual fuel used. And this is the real big issue, isn't it?
There is a lot to do. On one hand, we are in the refleeting program. Unfortunately, Boeing is late, but when we will have the renewed fleet, it will be 15 to 20% less emission. We see through other means, another 10% points, we can decrease the emission. If we would have a European sky, we could reduce by another 10%. So I think it's possible to come close to the 50% reduction. The rest we have to do with sustainable fuel. Again, it's also quite interesting. You see, I think last year, 2%, it goes up to 4% or 5%. And more technical solutions will come. They will not come as quickly as the others, but I'm pretty sure in 10 years, the supply situation will be by far better than today. To support investments is so important and to have the right regulation to support these investments. And if airlines don't be profitable, it's very difficult to invest in a new fleet. So a lot of opportunity, but it's not only our task to do so, it's also the state who can do a lot.
Ryanair has blamed the Boeing delivery delays for cuts in its schedule for autumn and winter. How has it affected you and has it cost you more money?
First, Michael O'Leary is right with a lot of things he says. Second, we were lucky that we prolonged the aircraft we had. So there is not a direct impact, but of course, operating costs are higher.
What about compensation from Boeing?
That is an interesting question.
Have you had any?
Again, it's a interesting questions between long-lasting supplier-customer, you know, long-lasting customer-supplier relationship.
So you've asked for some compensation, but I'm thinking from your reaction that you maybe haven't had any yet.
You can try two or three times again, but we are annoyed about the late delivery. We think that we have always been in a good collaboration to overcome challenging situations.
Germany is going to hold elections early next year. As one of the largest German multinational companies, what would you like to see from a new government?
What we would like to see from the European government, including the German government, we are looking for less bureaucracy, less openness when it comes to technology, an easier tax regime to take out a lot of bureaucracy burden, which we have today, which is very difficult to cope with.
Are you happy that there will be an election next year?
I think we need to rethink the economical policy. And I hope that whoever forms the new government really puts a lot of effort into it, because the deindustrialization we have seen in Germany, and we have seen lower investment compared to depreciations, that has to stop. And we need a framework where companies are interested in investing in Germany again. And that's what we don't have at the moment.
That was Sebastian Abel, the CEO of TUI Group. We're listening to that is Russ Mould, Investment Director at AJ Bell. TUI share price, as we said there to Mr. Abel, it fell by about 8% this morning after they released their results. It is back up where it was before now. But just explain how your take on why that happened, Russ.
Hello, Sam. I think it was because, I mean, the shares had already had a tremendous run this year. There were about an 18-month high going into the numbers, so expectations were already quite high. The numbers met those expectations. The forecast for next year, while solid, wasn't any better than expected, so initially some profit-taking, but then clearly some other investors have come in afterwards to think maybe that share price was a little bit too much, given that consumers still seem happy to spend on experiences, perhaps more so than they do on goods at the moment.
Well, let's talk about goods, because another big European company, Inditex, which owns the likes of Zara and Pull&Bear, reported an 8.5% rise in profits for the past 9 months. So what's that telling us about how consumers are feeling about buying goods across Europe?
I mean, again, the Inditex statement was very solid, and their statement on November and early Christmas trading was also very strong. Perhaps, again, it's just an issue of where the share price is at nearly an all-time high on the Madrid Stock Exchange. So, again, expectations very high. And there are some challenges out there. Competition from, you know, Temu, Shein and other online vendors, and also the movements of the euro against the dollar has hit the company's cost base a little bit. So again, it was maybe the absence of an upside surprise rather than numbers themselves being disappointing.
How are retailers going into, well, they're in the golden quarter, aren't they? We're fast approaching Christmas. How are they feeling, do you think, overall?
We'll find out. I mean, Inditex obviously had a particularly big challenge given the horrible Spanish floods that we saw, but they said the overall impact of that has been relatively limited so far. So there are lots and lots of different moving parts, depending on where the retailer sells, which segment of the market it addresses, and what price points.
Ross, we will come back to you in a moment. We're going to have a look at some inflation data now. We'll have a look at the US data just a moment. But let's first of all go to South Africa, where food prices have risen at their lowest rates in nearly 14 years. And that's kept the country's inflation below expected levels. So inflation stood at 2.9% in the year to November. But a significant challenge for the South African economy remains high unemployment rates, with one in three adults out of work and actively looking for work. Umkhonto Haya and Esmeralda are both looking for jobs in Cape Town.
I haven't been working for a while now. It's almost going 6 months that I've been home. It's difficult if you are not working because things is not going easy for you. You are struggling here and there. I've been around to different places giving out my CVs and that, but there was no feedback on that. And then I just gave up like a month ago saying that I'm not going to go out because there's no income, but I'm spending on going out to places to give my CV in.
I'm a 50-year-old woman who's looking for a job, who's not working at the moment. I'm a single mother. I have kids to look after. Nah, life is very difficult for me. I did apply for jobs in many places. I used to drop my CVs in old age homes, but no reply. It makes me feel very bad. I've got that hope of one day we'll have a job.
For many years, South Africans have endured almost constant electricity shortages known as load shedding, which have significantly harmed businesses and the country's economy. However, since March this year, the issue seems to have been resolved, and that's to the delight of people there. Eric Shonmigun is the general manager of Eskom, the national power company.
We've actually placed more competent, experienced power station general managers at the more critical stations. The second dimension was the plant. We identified a 6 top performing plant that we're now not performing well, contributing to 70% of the breakdowns. We identified the critical areas that could actually improve the performance. And then the last dimension was the working with government to ensure that some of the processes that used to stifle implementation of projects, it was just taking too long to get some of the procurement issues approved. And then lastly was the assistance that we got from National Treasury. You can have the greatest plans, but if you don't have the funding, the monies to back that up, it becomes very difficult. So National Treasury, through the debt relief program of $254 billion, ensured that a fair amount of that was allocated to the generation recovery plan. We could now get on with actually doing long-term, planning for long-term outages.
So that was Eric Shonmigun. He's the general manager of Eskom, speaking to us from South Africa. Ross Mould is still with us. Let's talk about US inflation, because it's proving a little bit sticky, isn't it? So consumer prices increased by the most in 7 months in November, increasing by 0.3%. So what's behind this?
Yeah, the annual rate re-accelerated as well to 2.7% year on year. There was some good news in lower energy, oil and used car prices, goods. The bad news was that services prices were, again, to use that word, sticky, particularly transport, shelter and rent, and car insurance was particularly became much more expensive. And those are products, services, that the prices don't always change every month. They change on maybe an annual basis. So again, shows that inflation could be sticky. Intriguingly, financial markets have kind of shrugged it off, saying they still think the Federal Reserve will cut interest rates next week on the 18th of December and maybe push two more cuts through in 2025. So financial markets still betting on a cooling in inflation, steady economic growth and lower interest rates from central banks, even if the inflation numbers not necessarily doing quite what they think they should be doing.
And it's a quarter of a point cut that we're expecting next week.
That's correct. And then markets are currently pricing in something like two more cuts next year to 4%. But that is less than they were expecting a few months ago, when maybe rates as low as 3.5% by next Christmas was the expectation. Maybe that's the impact of that stickier inflation that we're seeing.
And Russ, a very long conversation we'll be having next year about the impact of tariffs on inflation. But not that. Let's not get into that now.
Next time.
You're listening to World Business Report from the BBC World Service with me, Sam Fenwick. Now to Korea, and a standoff in South Korea between security guards protecting the South Korean president and police attempting to enter the presidential office appears to be over. Authorities are trying to investigate last week's imposition of martial law. President Yong Suk-yeol has refused to step down despite an impeachment vote and multiple calls for him to go. So could all this instability mean to lead to less investment in the economy? Han Kyo is a former South Korean trade minister and a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
I think this protracted political turmoil is beginning to affect the economy. You know, as you mentioned, the consumption seems to be weakening. Inbound travel is being affected. Some of those travels are being canceled, and also social gathering, dinner parties, etc., are being canceled. And also, it seriously is affecting investor confidence. So many businesses cannot really make investment decisions under this current political uncertainty.
Do you see an end to this political instability in South Korea in the next few weeks, or could this drag on for even longer?
I think that this is a very difficult situation. The most important thing is to really reflect the will of Korean people and, you know, bring normality and certainty into this political scene. I think this, the impeachment vote seems to be important, because if that happens, that in a way provides some certainty about what's the next step. And then at least by next springtime, Korean people could expect some sort of a newly mandate, the new government is coming in.
Han Kyo was speaking to my colleague Rahul Tandon. Ross, as an investor, is South Korea somewhere where you might be thinking of putting money right now?
Well, I mean, investors have clearly been scared away because the KOSPI index is at a one-year low and no higher than it was nearly 5 years ago. And the Korean won has gone down sharply against the US dollar.
But that question is like raises, a 15-year low, isn't it?
It is, yes. That raises the 2009. So that raises the question of, well, actually, is the Korean currency cheap, and are Korean assets cheap? And is this actually a chance to buy because of the political uncertainty? Korea is the home to fantastic global manufacturers. And if you look at the KOSPI index, you know, three quarters of it is related to cyclical industries like industry or financials, consumer discretionary, and some brilliant technology companies. So it's a big play on global growth as much as it's on the domestic economy. So if you're bullish on the domestic, on the global economy, you may think Korea is a place that's well worth looking at, allowing for specific challenges like what's happening at Samsung Electronics right now and whether it's losing out in the global chip and AI race or not.
Russ Mould, thank you very much. Thank you very much from AJ Bell, their investment director. Let's have a talk now about driverless cars, because General Motors has announced that it's going to stop funding the development of the Cruise self-driving taxi. GM said that it's an increasingly competitive robo-taxi market, and that's the reason why they've decided to move out. In October, the Tesla boss Elon Musk unveiled the electric car giant's long-awaited robo-taxi. It's called the Cybercab, and they launched that at the Warner Brothers studio in California. Well, to tell us about a little bit more about all of this, Amanda Stretton joins us. She's a driver, a racing driver, and a motoring journalist. So is this market fairly crowded? Or is it just a few big players?
It is very crowded. And what happened a number of years ago is, as well as software companies getting involved in this market, legacy auto manufacturers also did. Really, what they were trying to do was sort of protect their brand, if you like. So looking far into the future, when we all finally do get into autonomous vehicles, what is going to differentiate a GM product from a VW product from a BMW, for example? So it is a very crowded market. And interesting what Mary Barra actually said, it's not really part of their core business anymore, because really what they need to be focusing on at the moment is their passenger cars. And what they're actually doing is putting all of this development into those personal vehicles.
So they have said, haven't they, that they will keep looking at autonomous personal vehicles. They're just going to move out of the taxi market.
That's right, exactly. So what we're going to be seeing, I mean, in the first transition, if you like, to autonomous vehicles, it will all be happening in personal vehicles. So the technology will be easy to move over. But this robo-taxi market is, as you say, very competitive. And other people like Ford and VW, who were in a joint partnership together in 2022, also announced they were going to be pulling out as well and really leaving it to the more software giants, the likes of Amazon and Google, and to a degree Tesla as well, who are really a software company essentially as well.
When is this going to happen? Because you did allude then to when we're all getting into our driverless cars. But you know, we've been talking about this for a good while, haven't we? 10 years or so. It doesn't seem, unless I'm mistaken, it doesn't seem to advance too quickly.
No. And I mean, if you just look at the UK in particular, the same is true the world over. But we've got so many fundamental problems that we need to address before we can even consider moving into an autonomous vehicle future. The infrastructure is just simply not there. We need to have far better roads, road surfaces. The lines need to be clear. Signage needs to be clear. Lighting needs to be clear. And of course, you also need connectivity. So you need to have a really robust 5G network with no black spots. And these are things that automakers have no control over. So we really need to have that sort of infrastructure in place before we're going to see the rollout. And of course, the other huge thing is legislation. These vehicles need to talk to each other. So whether you're in an Amazon powered vehicle or whether you're in a Google powered vehicle, these all need to talk to one another, but they also need to be able to talk to the cars that are still driven by humans. So legislatively, it's a real hot potato and nobody quite knows how to deal with it.
Amanda Stretton, it sounds like, if you'll forgive the pun, a long journey ahead. Thank you very much for joining us on World Business Report today. Now we're going to move on to our last story in the programme. And Saudi Arabia has successfully won its bid to host the 2034 Men's World Cup. It's the biggest event in sport. It's massive. Lots of people watch it. It was the only country in the running, and after hosting huge boxing title fights, launching LIV Golf around the world, and the creation of Saudi Formula One, they've even ventured into tennis. The kingdom's influence over sport is ever growing, and it doesn't seem to want to stop. So why do they want to do this? What's this big investment in sport all about? Let's talk to Stanis Ellsborg now. He's head of Play the Game, a research group at the Danish Institute for Sports Studies, and he's been looking into this for many years. Tell us, first of all, Stanis, what is the attraction then of Saudi Arabia investing so much money in these different sports?
Yeah, so I think we have to look at this is really a part of a well-crafted strategy to transform the kingdom's global image and wield sport as a powerful instrument of geopolitical influence. I mean, their sports strategy really seeks to divert attention from the realities of their human rights atrocities, and they want to gain power in the international political system.
There are people who say that, and I think they refer to it as sports washing, but the Saudi government might also say that it's part of their need to diversify their economy, and that it's not actually fair to say that it's part of a sports washing program. What do you make of that?
Well, it's pretty clear. I don't agree with the government of Saudi Arabia on these issues. I mean, in general, if you want to diversify your economy, sport is not the best place to put all your money in. It's rarely that you will get a return of investment in the billions of dollars they have used on sports. So they could use that more clever, I think. This is, first and foremost, a powerful instrument of geopolitical influence for the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
Can you take us through some of the figures then that you've come across in your years of research, looking at things like how much they've invested in boxing and golf, Formula One, Saudi Formula One? Take us through some of the figures.
Yeah, sure. So last week we actually released a new report on Saudi Arabia's investments in world of sport and how many sponsorships that they have put into the world of sport from 2024 and forward. And we have counted at least 910 Saudi sponsorships in sport. And that's, I mean, all over the place in terms of sports. You mentioned a few of them. Of course, football is a very, very big, very big sport that they have invested in. And they are using the public investment fund, the National Sovereign Wealth Fund, which is one of the most wealthiest funds all over the world, to directly sponsor into sponsorship, but they also have many subsidiaries that they use to sponsor sport. For an example, NEOM, which will also be one of the host cities of the World Cup. They have the Savai Games Group, which is the esports company. So they invest a lot in sport. And we have counted 910 sponsorships from 2024 and on.
And the World Cup is a pinnacle sport to have, isn't it?
Absolutely. It is the biggest sports event, as you just mentioned, together with the Olympics. So this is the pinnacle of Mohammed bin Salman's sports strategy so far. Now they will have the World Cup. Now they will set sight on the Olympics as well.
Just the fact that they're able to host it alone, whereas the two World Cups before that will be in lots of different countries. Does that make a difference, do you think?
I'm not sure what indifference in what terms, but it of course makes the difference that they can decide totally between themselves what they want to do with this World Cup, how they want to present it, how many buildings they want to present and build prior to the World Cup. And they are an autocratic regime, so they pretty much want to work alone.
Stanis Ellsberg, thank you very much. We will have to leave it there. Thank you for joining us today on World Business Report. And thank you to you for listening. That's all we have time for. Please join us again tomorrow at the same time.